My title was kind of assigned to me, so here's my title, Lessons for Quantum Gravity from Quantum Information. I'll sort of talk about that. But I first wanted to make some general remarks. So first I wanted to ask about the question, why is quantum gravity hard? Why are we still here at this conference, 50 years after the other forces were understood? And there are various reasons which people sometimes give. One of them is non-renormalizability. But I think that's not a very good reason, because lots of theories are non-renormalizable. The theory of pions is non-renormalizable. But in that case, we were able to, in fairly short order, figure out a UV completion in terms of QCD. So just because something's non-renormalizable doesn't mean we're going to need to reinvent physics to understand it. Similarly, another thing people sometimes talk about is diffeomorphism invariance. But actually, no, that also by itself doesn't guarantee that life will be difficult. For example, in low enough dimension, there are theories that are fully diffeomorphism invariant, such as the theory of the world line of a particle, or this Jacquive-Teitelboehm gravity that's recently back in fashion. And both of these can be quantized in the usual way without any difficulty. You just land on a standard quantum mechanical system that has full diff invariance. So diff invariance by itself also is not necessarily going to give you a problem. What is going to give you a problem is having black holes. So the thing that I think, certainly based on experience, but I think also based on general principles, the reason why quantum gravity, of the kind that we have in our real world, is difficult is because of black holes. So one way you can think about this is that black holes create an obstruction to formulating quantum gravity in terms of local fields. So for example, if you try to do a scattering experiment to probe short distances, well, in quantum field theory, we know how that works. Going to higher energy, you're probing shorter and shorter distance scales. But in gravity, the opposite is true. At some point, as you increase the energy, you're just making a black hole, which is bigger and bigger, instead of probing shorter and shorter distances. Another way you can think about that is, you try to make a bunch of rods and clocks that can localize observables at the Planck scale, and you just invariably find that your collection of rods and clocks is just going to collapse into a black hole before it's able to tell you anything interesting. Another comment along this direction is that if you just nonetheless postulate a local field description, you say, okay, I'm not going to worry about, if I can probe the fields in the usual way, I just imagine there's a local field description anyways. But this seems to lead to black holes that have too many degrees of freedom, in the sense that they have degrees of freedom, more degrees of freedom than the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy would suggest. This is interesting, but it's also kind of a challenge, because since all of the other forces we understand using local fields, if we're going to give up on local fields and try and come up with something else that's fancy enough to deal with black hole physics, then we need to create some new kind of mathematical structure that we don't have much precedent for in the rest of physics. So how can we do that? Well, obviously the best thing would be if we could do experiments and then nature would tell us, and then we wouldn't have to figure it out ourselves. Unfortunately, that so far has not proved to be very promising, just because, the Planck energy is very high, and it's hard for us to probe physics directly at the Planck scale. I do nonetheless think that there has been and will continue to be useful experimental input, especially from cosmology. For example, whatever quantum gravity theory we invent, it needs to be able to account for inflation, and also something like a positive cosmological constant today. So people who can only come up with theories that don't satisfy these properties, such as myself in this talk, don't get to declare victory on quantum gravity. Another thing we can do is study toy models. So we can say, rather than trying to do everything all at once, we consider simpler theories, which have some unrealistic features. For example, like the number of dimensions might not be four, the cosmological constant might have the wrong sign, we might have unbroken supersymmetry. But nonetheless, these theories still capture some aspects, like having black holes, of what we think real quantum gravity should have. And so examples of this are string theory and ADS-CFT. Then a third approach is rather than trying to guess the fundamental picture or some model of it, you just look at perturbative quantum gravity and you think about it really hard. You know, you try to extract some sort of general principles or guess some general principles just based on studying the part of quantum gravity that we do understand, the perturbation theory in G. Newton, and then hope that those principles that we extract can somehow suggest how we should proceed. You know, and that's something that has had worked historically, right? You know, Einstein kind of did that with Maxwell's equations and so on. Now, this is great if you're smart, if you're really smart like Einstein. But the danger with this third strategy, right, is what if you just end up with the wrong principles, right? Like you might think you extracted the right principles, but actually you didn't. So I would say that a lot of the progress of the last decade has really come from using tools from quantum information theory to combine, to relate these second two strategies. So you know, so that they feed back and forth into each other. So you take advantage of the fact that we do have these toy models like ADS, CFT, and string theory to think about what happens in those models, but then you try to kind of step away from the specifics of the models and see if you can understand it from a more general semi-classical point of view, or vice versa. You can come up with candidate principles based on the semi-classical approach and then test them against these toy models and see if your principles held, at least in those toy models. Now more concretely, I think that now it's become clear that over the last 10 or 15 years, the real advances in understanding quantum gravity, at least from this approach that I'm advocating here, has come from this discovery of a new formula for the von Neumann entropy in a gravitational system. And so I'm going to just flash the formula here, and then I'm going to explain it more later in the talk. This formula is called the quantum extremal surface formula, and I'll explain more about it a little bit later. So among the things that we learn from the quantum extremal surface formula, so we learn about this thing called entanglement wedge reconstruction. I'll say what that is. But among other things, that explains how, at least within ADS CFT, the dual CFT, which is kind of the non-perturbative quantum gravity description, is able at least sometimes to tell you what's going on in the interiors of black holes, which is rather non-trivial, right? Because you know any simple procedure involving causal physics in the bulk won't be able to tell you what's going on inside of the black hole. So, you know, because anything that's in there has to somehow go through the singularity before it comes back out, if it comes back out. Another thing we learned from this formula is that, again, at least within ADS-CFT, there are no global symmetries in the bulk. So you can use this entanglement wedge reconstruction to show that, and I'll also talk a little bit about that. And then more recently, it's been shown that by applying this formula in certain examples where you can set everything up carefully enough, you can actually use it to account for the unitarity of black hole evaporation in the sense of you can compute this so-called Page curve, which again, I'll explain about it a little bit more if you don't know what it is, and see that the Page curve that you get is consistent with the idea that Hawking radiation is unitary. So in the rest of the talk, what I'm going to do is I'm going to review the quantum extremal surface formula, and then I'll tell you a bit about these three applications of it. But first, let me just ask if there are any questions. And let me say, like, questions that are kind of high-level conceptual questions maybe are better to say for the end of the talk. So ideally, questions during the talk will be more sort of concrete or aimed at the technical topics. Okay, so I'll just pause for 5 seconds. And hopefully anyone who has a question can unmute themselves.
They should be able to.
Okay. All right. Well, why don't we continue then? And then I'm sure there'll be plenty to discuss once we get into the specifics. So I want to begin with a celebration of magic. We're lucky in this field that we have access to an oracle whose pronouncements we can listen to, even if we don't always understand them, and then do our best to live by them. And our oracle is the Euclidean gravity path integral. Now, in ordinary quantum systems, the Euclidean path integral is not that exciting because it's just equivalent to the standard operator formalism of quantum mechanics, or equivalently the Lorentzian path integral. So for example, you can imagine some partition function here of some quantum system. Well, its definition is that it's the trace of e to the minus beta h. And then you can just break up this trace into a bunch of little pieces and you derive formulas like this, where you say that this is equal to an integral over periodic field configurations with time periodicity beta. And then, you know, with the Euclidean version of the action. But in quantum gravity, things are more interesting because we don't have a non-perturbative picture of the Hilbert space in terms of the metric and the matter fields in the gravitational system. So the second equality here, this one is not so clear, right? Like, we can still try to do this integral in terms of the, at least perturbatively, in terms of the metric and the matter fields, but we don't know how to interpret it as a trace in a Hilbert space where states in that Hilbert space are labeled by metric configurations. And the rather remarkable thing, though, is that if we just nonetheless assume that there is some Hilbert space where this equality holds, then by evaluating the path integral, we can learn a lot about what's going on in that Hilbert space. So the canonical example of this is the Euclidean Schwarzschild geometry. So here I've written it in four dimensions, where if you evaluate the Euclidean action, and you are careful to keep track of all the terms, then you fairly quickly arrive at this famous Bekenstein-Hawking formula for the entropy of a black hole as being equal to the area of the horizon divided by 4g. And this Euclidean calculation is due to Gibbons and Hawking, and then also an ADS done by Hawking and Page. So this is really an amazing fact. I mean, it has bothered me / enchanted me for a decade, because somehow the Euclidean path integral, which is just some boring integral over metrics with the Einstein action, knows the number of microstates of a black hole, even though those microstates can't be described in terms of the semi-classical Hilbert space of general relativity. We don't know how to make those microstates out of the metric tensor. People sometimes fantasize about it, but it's never been done. But somehow this Euclidean path integral knows the answer anyways. And that's the oracle at work, telling us the answer without telling us why it's true. Now, this sounds so crazy that you might even think it's just obviously wrong, but in fact it's not. And the reason is because if you think about this geometry, the Euclidean Schwarzschild geometry, the circle, the tau circle, which is the thing you're viewing as the thermal circle, isn't really a circle because it actually contracts at r equals rs. And so actually, if you really try to start, instead of with the path integral, to start with this trace of e to the minus beta h, and you try to compute the trace in the semi-classical Hilbert space, you wouldn't actually include this configuration because you would say it's not a legal contribution because the topology doesn't have, you know, because it doesn't have a circle because the circle contracts. But nonetheless, you can say, okay, well, let's not be so fussy as that. It's a computation that gives an answer that seems to, you know, be reasonable, so maybe it's right. And in fact, in every situation where we can actually test this formula, which requires using these toy models that I mentioned earlier, such as in string theory or ADS-CFT or the SYK model, then actually the formula works. And so then there is some Hilbert space, which is not made out of the metric tensor and so on. But there is some Hilbert space where when you compute the trace of e to the minus beta h, then the entropy that comes out is consistent with this formula. Okay, so let's continue. So, maybe let me just make a comment about quantum information theory here. This is one way of thinking about why quantum information theory is helpful, is because we have a machine that gives us the entropy of a state without telling us what the state is. And quantum information theory is very good at kind of manipulating entropies and using them to learn things about the state, even if you maybe didn't know the state before or weren't capable of computing that entropy yourself. If the oracle gives it to you, then there's a lot that you can learn. Now, in ADS-CFT,
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, sure. Let's have a question.
Your statement that it's a surprising fact that the Euclidean path integral gives the correct expression for the entropy.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not really that surprising, right? I mean, because the entropy is the measure of the number of microstates. And then we know, for example, from Jacobson's work that one can derive the Einstein-Hilbert action by making an assumption of thermodynamic equilibrium.
Yeah, but I think that's kind of using this as input, right? I mean, I think if you just try to do this, you know, in the naive way of where you derive the Euclidean path integral for an ordinary system, it would just tell you not to include this geometry. And the fact that including it anyway is the right thing to do, I think, is not obvious. I mean, you can, you know, we've now all had 40 years to think about it and we've kind of accepted it, okay? But I'm going to stick with the statement that it's very surprising. I mean, it's not true like in other realms of physics that only knowing the low energy physics tells you how many UV degrees of freedom there are, right? It's not true. Like if you just know quantum electrodynamics, you're not going to be able to figure out from that that there have to be W and Z boson, right? I mean, you have to know that there are other UV completions where it's not true. Whereas
can I intervene, yeah, if you don't mind?
Yeah, sure.
I have an answer to this, which is related to an email I sent you a couple of days ago.
Well, okay, why don't we do this at the end? I think this sounds like a more conceptual thing. So why don't we do that at the end of the talk, okay? If you don't mind.
Okay, sure, sure.
Because I want to continue with the technical part. Thank you. Okay. So now let's continue. So now let me start talking. So I mentioned it before, but now let me start talking about what we get from using ADS-CFT. So in general, the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, we think of it as a kind of coarse-grained entropy. And coarse-grained entropy is a kind of vague notion because I think one of the previous speakers also mentioned, it depends on the choice of ensemble and so on. But at least in ADS-CFT, we can also think about the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, at least at sufficiently high temperature, as being the fine-grained von Neumann entropy of the thermal state. Rho is 1 over z times e to the minus beta h, where we really use von Neumann's formula, s is minus trace of rho log rho. And the reason we can do that is because what we get from ADS-CFT is a non-perturbatively precise picture of the Hilbert space and the dynamics. In terms of the boundary CFT. So the correspondence says that a quantum gravity in asymptotically ADS space is just defined as a CFT living on the boundary of the space, and there's a one-to-one map between the Hilbert spaces. So then in the CFT, you can really just compute the trace in the usual way, and it should be consistent with what you get by doing Euclidean gravity in the bulk. Whereas when we're not in ADS, we don't know what that non-perturbative Hilbert space is, and so it's harder to make statements like that. Now, 14 years ago, in what I would say was really the beginning of this new field that I work in, Ruin Takinagi made a remarkable conjecture, really amazing. Lauren, you want to ask a question? Sure, go ahead.
Maybe it's more of a conceptual question, but it's about this ultra reliance on the Euclidean path integral, which I understand, you know, in very symmetric situation. But you know, if you don't have a symmetric situation in general space time, I guess it is truly magic there, right? In general, okay. there won't be a slice where k vanish where you can map.
I agree with you that it's magic. Yes. I think in the discussion I'm about to give of Ruin Takinagi, we will apply it in a situation with no symmetry and it still seems to work. Yes.
So in that case, there you would have to have an understanding of what you mean by weak rotation.
Well, I think there's a version of it which is purely Lorentzian, actually. I'm not going to get into that in this talk, but I'll cite it in one of the references, but I won't get into it. But I'll mention it when I come to it for you.
Okay.
So 14 years ago, Ruin Takinagi made a remarkable conjecture saying that not only can the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy and ADS-CFT be interpreted as a fine-grained entropy of the thermal state, in fact, for any subregion of the boundary. So here, this circle, you can think of this disk as a time slice in the bulk, its boundary, this circle is a time slice in the boundary. And for any spatial subregion in the boundary, like this interval here on the circle, And for any, quote, reasonable state in the CFT Hilbert space, and then for them, they also had to assume that there was a moment of time reflection symmetry, which maybe is related to what Laurent was getting at. Then actually the fine-grained von Neumann entropy of the reduced state on rho r can be computed by a gravitational calculation, which doesn't look that different from Gibbons and Hawking. What it says is you look for a codimension two surface in the bulk whose boundary is equal to the boundary of r, so that's called being anchored to r. You also demand that xr is homologous to r, which means that xr and r together are the boundary of this red surface, which I call little r. And then you take the minimum over all such surfaces of the area divided by 4g. And to leading order in g Newton, that's supposed to be the von Neumann entropy of this state, the real fine-grained von Neumann entropy of the state. So this is a vast generalization of Gibbons and Hawking, because this is, you know, saying that for any state, up to this issue of the time reflection symmetry, which we're going to get rid of in a minute, you know, pretty much any state, and for any subregion, we can still compute the fine-grained entropy in the microscopic non-perturbative Hilbert space just by looking at the area of this surface. Now, this was quickly generalized to get rid of this annoying assumption of time reflection symmetry by Hubeni, Rangamani, and Takinagi. And then in further work, Fautner, Lukwitz, Molisena, and then Engelhardt and Wall explained how to generalize the formula to include higher order corrections in G, right? So this one, it was true only up to order G to the zero, whereas this one is supposed to be true for all orders in G. So let's look at the formula now. So since we've gotten rid of time reflection symmetry, so I have to draw a Lorentzian picture. This is the Lorentzian picture that I'm drawing. So here's our boundary time interval, our spatial space interval R. We look for the surface XR, so this XR still has to be homologous to R, and it still has to be anchored to R in the sense that the boundary of this surface equals the boundary of R. And then first we take this area of the surface divided by 4G and then add to it some corrections, which I won't discuss. But now we also add to it the entropy of the bulk fields that are living on this surface here, which lies in between XR and R. So in the previous slide, that was this red region here. Here I've kind of, it's sitting in the middle of this wedge here. And so if you like, this is the entropy of bulk matter fields in between XR and R. We add to that the area. The idea is then we extremize. So we look for all of the extremal values as with respect to XR. And then if there's more than one extremum, then we take the one which is smallest. And that gives us the von Neumann entropy of the R here. And so now this is a fully covariant formula, works in Lorentzian signature, makes no symmetry assumptions, well, except asymptotically ADS spacetime. So this is called the quantum extremal surface formula. So this is the modern formula for entropy, for fine-grained entropy in gravitational systems. Now, it'll be important in a sec, so let me just mention that this time slice here between XR and R, you can take its domain of dependence in the bulk. That gives you this kind of wedge here, and that's called the entanglement wedge. So I'm just introducing that terminology because I'm going to use it in a minute. Right. Now, the quantum extremal surface formula has been checked in a lot of situations. It always works as far as we can tell. But in fact, there are two, in addition to this sort of, you know, empirical way of testing it. There are also two different ways that you can think about it from the top down, why it must be true. So the first is, again, Euclidean gravity magic. So it turns out that this Gibbons-Hawking calculation of the black hole entropy based on the Euclidean path integral can actually be justified, it can be generalized to justify the quantum extremal surface formula. So this was done in a sequence of papers. So the first one with the basic idea was this paper of Lukwitz and Molisena, although that one was still restricted to having this time reversal symmetry. Then in this paper, they explained how to derive the bulk entropy piece, again, still assuming time reversal symmetry. And then these ones showed how to do it in Lorentzian signature without assuming time reversal symmetry. So then when I say Euclidean gravity magic, I mean sort of some more complex gravity magic, right? So they're parts of the thing which are Euclidean and parts that are Lorentzian. So somehow the oracle, in addition to knowing the entropy of the black hole, also knows what's the entropy of this subregion in the CFT, and it tells us that it's equal to this quantum extremal surface formula. So another victory for the Euclidean gravity path integral. Well, or at least, another remarkable suggestion from the Euclidean gravity path integral. Now, in fact, there's another way to think about the formula, which is in terms of this idea of quantum error correction. So I don't really have time to get into it in this talk in detail, though I'll say a little more on the next slide. But the embedding of bulk effective field theory into ADS-CFT can be thought of as a quantum error correcting code. So quantum error correcting codes are protocols which were invented to protect quantum computers against decoherence. But the relevant thing here is that you can actually show that pretty much any quantum error correcting code must obey some version of the quantum extremal surface formula. And so that the quantum error correction gives you another way of thinking about why a formula like this should be true, that somehow is independent of the Euclidean gravity starting point. The rest of the talk I'm gonna spend reviewing some of the things we learned from the quantum extremal surface formula, but first let me pause and ask if there are any more questions. You can just unmute yourself and ask, it's fine with me.
So one quick question. Is there an easy way of understanding how the state of the CFT comes in this formula, since the way you've described it is basically purely geometric?
Well, yeah, that's the interesting thing, right? So it shows up in the left-hand side of the formula, right? And so we could also ignore the right-hand side of the formula and just compute the left-hand side using minus trace of rho log rho in the dual CFT. The surprising thing here is that that is equal to the right-hand side, right? I mean, that's the thing that didn't need to be true. I guess in both of these ways of thinking about it, there's kind of a way of understanding that, right? So in the Euclidean picture, you start with the so-called replica trick in the dual CFT, which is the calculation you would do just to compute the entropy in the CFT. And that recasts the entropy as some partition function or derivatives of partition functions. But then you turn it into a bulk calculation by filling in whatever the bulk geometries can be that match up with that boundary partition function calculation, and then evaluate the action. And when you evaluate it, what you end up with is the right-hand side of this formula. You can also think about it in the quantum error correction point of view. There you just, by knowing how the bulk theory is embedded into the CFT, you can actually just do the CFT calculation of minus trace of rho log rho using within quantum error correction formalism, and you find that it's equal to something that looks like this. It's a little bit more general because quantum error correction is very general, but it's a formula which is very similar to this one. This formula is kind of a special case of that formula. Any other questions?
Well, maybe a short question about Stéphane. I guess that's what you mean by quantum error correction. Is it possible to free yourself a bit more from the Euclidean path integral and give a canonical account of these results?
That was the goal of the quantum error correction picture, which I'll say a little bit more about, but I would say it's not completely understood. But indeed, to me, the point of the quantum error correction is to not use the Euclidean path integral because it's an oracle that we don't understand. You know, doing this requires us to actually understand how the low energy effective field theory is embedded into the CFT. And clearly, if you know that, you don't need any oracles. You can just compute everything.
Yeah, I agree. And that would be a good meeting ground.
Yeah. And there are toy models where this can be done fully explicitly based on tensor networks and so on. I would say it hasn't been able to be done in a very explicit way for the cases that really look like general relativity at long distances. So I should continue, I think. So first I'll say a little bit more about this quantum error correction. So the quantum extremal surface formula has important consequences for something called subregion duality, which was an old conjecture that if I give you access in the CFT only to the observables in some boundary spatial subregion called R, then there should be some subregion about in the bulk where you can still learn everything about what's going on in that subregion. And at first it was not clear that this should be true. People thought maybe because of the Ruta-Kanagi formula, it might be true, but you know, at the time the Ruta-Kanagi formula was just a conjecture and you know. By using this quantum extremal surface formula with Shidong and Aaron Wall, we were able to show that this entailment wedge, which I drew earlier, this slice of cheese here, which is the domain of dependence of the space in between XR and R, actually is dual to R, to the boundary subregion R, in the sense that any, if you have access to all the CFD observables in this blue diamond, then you can learn everything in the bulk that's going on inside of this wedge. So this statement is called entailment wedge reconstruction. And just to mention kind of how crazy it is, one thing which I always have to say in any of my talks, like say you think about this I, let I be some degree of freedom sitting in here. Well, this little I is not in the entailment wedge of either this region one or this region two or this region three. So no single one of these can tell you what's going on in the little region in the with the degree of freedom I here. But the union of any two of them can, because the entanglement wedge of R1 union R2 has the surface XR here. And so all this is in it, including I. But the same is true for R2 and the union of R2 and R3, or the union of R1 and R3. So there's this kind of redundant encoding where the same information can be accessed in many different ways. And that's kind of the hallmark of quantum error correction, right? That's kind of how you protect information against noise. And the detailed study of this, you know, the way you prove this connection is using the mathematics of quantum error correcting code. So that's another place where, you know, tools from quantum information theory are very useful. Now, perhaps the most interesting consequence of entailment wedge reconstruction is that it tells us that at least in some cases, the boundary CFD degrees of freedom know what's going on behind black hole horizons. So let me just show a picture. So over here, I've got the maximally extended Penrose diagram of the ADS-Schwarzschild black hole. So here's the singularities here and here. So if you try to learn about what's going on in the interior using conventional techniques, say by sending in a particle here and a particle here, and then they scatter and you want to know what comes out, you've got this problem that whatever comes out ends up in the singularity. So it doesn't come out to the boundary in any obvious way via causal propagation. So for example, just by looking at low point correlators of boundary operators, you can't learn about what's going on in here. And in fact, it was even suggested that in ADS CFD, you can't learn about what's going on inside a black hole horizon, that somehow the duality ends at the edge of the horizon. But in fact, well, I don't know about the duality, but the entanglement wedge definitely does not end at the edge of the horizon. One way to see that is to make the wormhole a little bit wider by throwing in some matter, which I haven't shown explicitly here. And then you see the right exterior is this dark blue region, but then the entanglement wedge actually also contains this light blue region here, which is behind the horizon. Or if you allow yourself to access both of the boundaries, then everything is in the entanglement wedge. So including everything up towards the singularity. Okay, so I'm gonna return to this question of the black hole interior soon. Let me now again ask if there are any more questions about this coding stuff. Otherwise, I'm going to switch to global symmetries. Going once, going twice. Okay, so no global symmetries in quantum gravity. So this is another application of the quantum extremal surface formula. So it's an old piece of lore in quantum gravity that there can't be global symmetries. It goes back, you know, ages. And for continuous global symmetries, there's a heuristic argument for this, which is based on using the Bekenstein-Hawking formula for black hole entropy. And another sort of, quote, empirical piece of evidence for this is that all known compactifications of string theory have neither discrete nor continuous global symmetries. Lee, if your question is about the previous section, ask it now. If it's about this one, let's ask it at the end of this section, okay? So recently, Hiroshi Aguri and I were able to use entanglement wedge reconstruction to argue that indeed there are no bulk global symmetries in ADS CFT. So let me first remind you that in quantum field theory, what do we mean by global symmetry? We mean a symmetry which acts faithfully on the set of local operators at each point in X. So say O sub I are the set of local operators. We conjugate them by the symmetry and they transform in some representation. And crucially, acting faithfully means that for every element of G, which is not the identity, then there's some O which transforms non-trivially. Okay, so that's what we mean by global symmetry as opposed to gauge symmetry or something else. Now, the essential feature of global symmetry is that if you want to know how much charge there is in a region of space, then you have to go visit each point and see. So if the symmetry is continuous, we can express that easily by saying that the charge in a region R is just the integral of J0 over the region. So you just have to add up all the charge in the region. There's no way for you otherwise to know how much charge is inside. Now, the idea of our proof that there are no global symmetries is that if there were a global symmetry in the bulk, it would also imply a global symmetry in the boundary. But we can split the boundary up into pieces. So here I chose to split it into 8 pieces. And then the total charge on the whole boundary is just going to be the sum of the charge in this region, plus the charge in this region, plus the charge in this region, plus the charge in this region. So that's the kind of local property of a global symmetry in quantum field theory. But you see, then we're immediately going to run into a contradiction because, well, by assumption, if there's a global symmetry in the bulk, then there should be some object which is charged under it. So let's put one in the center of the space here. Now, the issue is that each of these Qs, which in the boundary detects all the charge in this region, really can only detect charge in the bulk, which lives inside of its entanglement wedge. And this point here is not in the entanglement wedge of any of these pieces. So this operator can't detect the charge, this operator can't detect the charge, and so on. But then none of them can detect it, and therefore the sum can't detect it either, and therefore the operator couldn't have been charged in the first place, which is a contradiction. So that's the contradiction which tells us there are no global symmetries. Now, the way I phrase this here, I use the charge, so that was an argument for continuous symmetries, but there's a slightly fancier version of the argument that works also for discrete symmetries. And actually, both of the arguments are related to something called the Easton-Knill theorem in quantum information theory. Now, let me just mention, so you might say, oh my God, but what about gauge symmetries? We have those in the real world. Those better not be forbidden by quantum gravity. They're not. And the reason is because if you have a gauge symmetry, then this charged operator here always has to come with a Wilson line attached to it that runs off to infinity. And then that charged line is always going to end up in the entanglement wedge of one of these regions. And so there's no contradiction for gauge symmetries, which is good because all the examples of ADS-CFT that we know do have gauge symmetries in the bulk. So if we ruled them out, we'd have made a mistake. Okay, so let's now pause for questions about this part.
Dan, how do you know that if there's a global symmetry in the bulk, then there's also a global symmetry in that course that measures the same charge in the boundary?
Yeah, so then you have to look at, you have to think a little bit more about the definitions on both sides. But the short answer is that you have, since the Hilbert spaces are isomorphic and since the local operators in the boundary are the limits of local operators in the bulk, if you have a representation of the symmetry group on the Hilbert space that acts locally on bulk local operators, then it also has to act locally on boundary local operators, but then that's the definition of a global symmetry in the boundary. That's discussed in a lot more detail in our paper, which I'm embarrassed to say is 180 pages long. There's a short version though, which maybe you want to read that one first. Other questions?
Could I ask a question?
Yeah, hey Tony.
Hey. Is there a generalization to this argument where you are like considering these models where you have different numbers of boundaries and possibly like changing the number of boundaries? So like a theory that encompasses both a one boundary and a two boundary setup?
Well, you could put, I mean, I guess even in ADS-CFT, you can take the direct sum over different boundary configurations if you want to. But usually we say there's no dynamical mixing between those. I think you're wondering about these funny bulk theories like of Merrill from Maxfield, whatever, is that what you're coming from?
Kind of, yeah, roughly. Yeah, just
so that's not holography. So, you know, I don't know what that is, but this argument works for holography.
So you're saying it doesn't directly apply to whatever that is, maybe?
No, not necessarily. Yeah. And in fact, maybe I should add actually, so that there are examples of low dimensional quantum gravity theories that do have global symmetries. So for the string world sheet is an example, and Jakeev Tadaboyam is another example. But those theories aren't really, they're not holographic, right? They don't really have a black hole information problem in the usual sense, at least not if you quantize them in the usual way. So these arguments apply only to theories that are holographic. I believe that any theory which is interesting enough to have a black hole information problem will be holographic and these arguments will apply. But these other funny theories, you know, that are kind of make sense by themselves with bulk Lagrangians, these arguments don't have to apply.
So Daniel, would you say this holds for, say, the CGHS model, which is still low dimensional and there's some notion of an information problem?
I think in this, well, okay, so we can debate about what exactly the lesson of the CGHS model is. The version of it which I understand, it just has information loss. So you could say it has an, I would say the CGHS doesn't have an information problem though, because there's no sense in which the Hilbert space entropy of the black hole is finite if you quantize it in the usual way. I guess I would say the CGHS model is allowed to have a global symmetry, but it's not holographic.
Okay, I have a follow-up question, but I'll take that off this talk.
Okay, let's do it after the talk. So, I want to talk about the information problem. So why don't we go on to that, and then we can do more questions at the end of the talk. The black hole information problem is great. It's wonderful. It's like the infrared catastrophe in thermodynamics, or inconsistency of Maxwell's equations without the displacement current. You know, somehow it's telling us that our best theory of nature is incomplete. And since Hawking's paper, this is, as someone of the earlier speakers said, you know, people have been working on this forever, and a lot of the time not much is happening because it's a hard problem. But every now and then there's a period where major developments happen, and lucky us, we're in one of the periods where major developments are happening. And this began last year with two really nice papers, one by Jeff Pennington and then one by Ahmed Almiri, Ned Engelhardt, Don Meroff, and Henry Maxfield. I think Ahmed, Netta, and Henry are participating in this conference. And it's sort of starting from those papers has continued throughout the year with a bunch of interesting results from various directions. So the basic idea of the black hole information problem, so since time is running out, I'll say this fast, right? You know, the rate of particle production tells you that the particles are produced in a mixed state. So as time goes on, more and more of the particles come out and the radiation is just getting more and more mixed. But eventually the radiation is all that's left. And so then the pure state evolved to a mixed state, and what happened? And this is usually represented graphically using this page curve, right? So Hawking's calculation says, if you look at the entropy of the radiation as a function of time, it just goes up, 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 and then the black hole is done evaporating, and then it's just flat with whatever the final entropy of the radiation is, which is not what you would expect from unitarity, where with unitarity, you would instead expect that at some point it would have to turn over and come back down, because if the radiation is going to end up in a pure state, then its von Neumann entropy, its fine-grained entropy, has to be pure at the end of the evaporation. So showing how this page curve turns over and goes down has been one of the key requirements of solving the information problem. It's not the only requirement. Nobody reasonable says the problem is solved, but I would say that being able to compute it is progress towards solving the information problem. Now, since ADS-CFT is a non-perturbative theory of quantum gravity, in principle, somehow clearly we should, whatever the page curve is, at least within ADS-CFT, we should be able to compute it. But unfortunately, the black holes that we understand the best in ADS-CFT are those which are big, whose size is at least of order the curvature radius of ADS, and those don't evaporate because their Hawking radiation just bounces off the boundary and gets reflected back into the black hole. So they're sort of forever young, if you like. So the first key idea in these two papers I mentioned was to extend the system by allowing the bulk matter fields to propagate out of the ADS into some auxiliary bath system, which is coupled to the ADS at the boundary. And then once you allow that, then even the big black holes, which are the ones that we do understand, are able to evaporate. Okay, so that was insight number one. There were some previous papers that suggested this conceptually, but these were the first ones that showed how to compute it. The second idea, and this was, I think, really the key one, was not to compute the entropy of the radiation directly, but instead to use this quantum extremal surface formula. And this is busy, so it'll take me a sec to explain, but I'll try to get through everything. And so really the thing that to me was really shocking, I think the thing which really was the new ingredient, was that they realized that even though we're working perturbatively in G Newton, it's possible to have a quantum extremal surface which is not near any classical extremal surface. And the reason it's possible is because the bulk entropy appearing in the formula here, you see, has a short distance singularity when the region gets small, and you can balance that short distance singularity against the 1 over g here, so that in the variation of s, these two terms can compete with each other, even though this one naively looks like it's bigger by a factor of 1 over g. For an evaporating black hole, so you can view this here as the upper corner of the ADS Penrose diagram, Schwarzschild diagram, except now this used to be the ADS boundary, but now we're letting the bulk field sneak out into this auxiliary system here. And this auxiliary system we're going to take to not have gravity. So it'll just be some, you know, maybe the same bulk minor fields, but propagating on a fixed background. And so what they showed is that in this setup, when the black hole is old enough, there's a new quantum extremal surface inside the black hole, but very close to the horizon, sitting right here. And the way that you can kind of see that this is the quantum extremal surface is that, the naive thing to do is to not include this part here. This part, green part here, is sometimes called the island, the part that's behind the horizon. Don't include that, just include this. So we're computing now the von Neumann entropy of the radiation system here. But the problem is this, the bulk entropy here is very big if the black hole is old, because all the early radiation that came out down here is living in the bath over here. That's very large. And eventually we can actually win by including the Hawking partners of these early pairs, which are over in here, by allowing the entailment wedge to also contain this region here. And there's a price we pay, which is we pay the area in over 4G of this surface here. But if the bulk entropy of the Hawking radiation that's come out is comparable to the area of the remaining black hole, then we can actually win by including this surface. We can get something which is the global minimum. And so this surface, the nice thing about it is that its entropy that you compute from this formula is just the horizon area, because this thing is very close to the horizon. And so it decreases as the black hole shrinks in size. So this gives you a contribution to the entropy, which decreases with time. And remember from the page curve, that was what we wanted, right? What we were after was a calculation of the entropy of the radiation that decreases with time. And that's what the quantum extremal surface rule is giving us. It's telling us that once we include this island, then the entropy of the radiation goes down. And in some simple models, you can really do this calculation in complete detail. You can get explicit formulas for the page curve. Here's one example of a page curve. And so, like I said, the increasing part comes from the situation where the island is not contributing, but then the later part comes once the island is contributing. Now, there are many subtleties about this, and, you know, we have whole conferences and argue with each other all the time. I have a paper with Chris Akers and Netta, which gives an even simpler model that illustrates what some of the subtleties are. But it's very clear that something interesting is going on. So with that, let me conclude. So we've learned a lot already, but here are many things still to consider. So these are questions which have not been resolved, which we should resolve. So one is, what's the experience of an infalling observer into a typical black hole microstate? What level of approximate global symmetry is allowed in quantum gravity? So our argument ruled out exact global symmetries, but approximate symmetries may still be allowed. And then finally, how can we move beyond ADS CFT to more realistic cosmologies and the Big Bang? Clearly we've got to do that, or otherwise we're still going to be stuck in toy model land. So with that, thank you. And I'll turn it over to Stefan to mediate the questions. All right, thanks.
Okay, thank you. So we obviously had quite a few questions already during the talk. We're running quite late.
We also started late.
Yes, we did, definitely. So Lee had his hand up for a while. I don't know if there's still a question from Lee.
I'll make it a very quick question, which you probably can handle easily. So there used to be a query of the following form: black holes have negative specific heat. A conformal field theory is an ordinary quantum field theory which has positive specific heat. How can the one thing have an isomorphism to the other? And then would be some blah, blah, blah about instability and so forth. Are you able to address that more directly?
Yes, definitely. So that has to do with this big versus small black holes in ADS, right?
Yes.
Which was, so big black holes in ADS have a positive specific heat.
Right. So I'm not.
So at high enough temperature, the black holes in the CFT agree, right? So now you're worried about lower temperature. The black hole would be more like a Minkowski black hole, right?
Yes.
So the problem, though, is that those black holes evaporate. So in the thermal ensemble, most of the states aren't described by there being a small black hole. They're described by there being a gas of gravitons and photons and whatever, and then maybe every now and then a black hole. But a gas of gravitons and photons has a positive specific heat. So then, therefore, in both regimes, the specific heat is positive.
But I could make a state which was a small black hole and didn't have any of that radiation.
Yeah, you could, but it wouldn't be typical in the canonical ensemble or the microcanonical ensemble if it was the energy was low enough. So I can certainly always, in any ensemble, I can find weird states where the behavior looks different from what we expect in the ensemble, right? Like these are the states where all the particles in the gas are up in the corner of the room. So it's true. It's true. There are states like that, but we don't say therefore the usual picture of the equilibrium of the gas is wrong.
Okay.
I'm just going to take one more question in the interest of time. I think Steve Giddings was next.
I had a comment on the Euclidean action which got held up.
Yeah, there was, Tejinder did ask a question that was delayed during the talk, so maybe we should at least address it.
Something important to say about the Euclidean action. There's at least one good way to understand why the Euclidean action knows about black hole microstates. That's because there's a result in Riemannian geometry that the trace of the square of the Dirac operator on the manifold is actually the Euclidean Einstein-Hilbert action. Now, there's a theory due to Stefan Adler, the theory of trace dynamics, where you can show that the black hole arises as a condensate of fermions. And the black hole entropy comes from fermionic microstates as computed in the conventional way. And that turns out to be trace of the square of the Dirac operator, and hence the Euclidean action. It was very surprising for me also, but then I realized that it is the Dirac operator connection with the Einstein-Hilbert action that makes this possible.
All right, well, thanks for the comment. Maybe we should hear what Steve was going to say also.
Thanks. So thanks for a very nice talk, Dan. A lot of what you say relies on this quantum extremal surface formula. And if you ask where that comes from, which you mentioned, really, an underlying assumption there appears to be a solution of the bulk constraints. In other words, since that's probably got to be true at the non-perturbative level, really one has to understand the unitary non-perturbative evolution in the bulk as part of deriving the QES formula.
So, well, I think that's kind of the second approach here, right? Is kind of trying to do that. We can just use the Euclidean oracle, right? I mean, I share your discomfort with using the Euclidean oracle, but...
Two comments on that. That relies in the way that you folks have said it on the JLMS paper, and they assume the constraints if you dig deep enough. I've also run it by... You cite Shi Dong here a few times. I've run this statement by him, and he basically agrees, I think.
Well, I'm not sure that I'm disagreeing with you. I mean, I also... think we haven't understood the non-perturbative bulk dynamics.
It's kind of like saying we need to solve the problem to solve the problem. It almost, I'm worried it becomes a little circular.
But I mean, Steve, I said we didn't solve the problem, right? I mean, right. I think we should believe the quantum extremal surface formula to the same extent that we believe the Bekenstein-Hawking formula. And I think you would agree that we don't have like a purely bulk explanation of the Bekenstein-Hawking formula, except maybe in very supersymmetric black holes and string theory, right?
Yeah.
So, and I think that this is similar to that. So, you know, you probably believe the Bekenstein-Hawking formula, and I believe it too, and I guess I believe the quantum extremal surface formula also, especially since it gives us all this nice stuff. But indeed, we that doesn't mean that we really understand it.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah.
Okay, I think we have to leave it there. I'm sorry. Let me remind everyone that the discussion should continue in the Slack channel. And it was clearly a very interesting talk and has led to a lot of discussion already. So let's thank Daniel again for this great talk.